In cybersecurity, speed is survival. SOC Radar is your early warning system, monitoring external threats to your company to spot risks before breaches. SOC Radar delivers proactive threat intelligence with actionable insights for holistic exposure management across attack surfaces, dark web, and brand protection. With automated detection, triage, and investigation, SOC Radar is your business's frontline defense. Start your free trial at socradar.io/podcast. That's socradar.io/podcast. Don't wait.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got you covered with comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting, confident looks you can count on. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence. With the new Ace line, looking effortlessly sophisticated this fall is easy and comfortable. Stock up on crazy cozy sweatpants, shorts, and sweatshirts that elevate your style. They even have blazers, if you're lucky enough to grab one while they're in stock. Mack Weldon balances classic pieces with updated details to keep you looking sharp, not flashy. Just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code MACK25.
Hey there, ACRackers. I want to tell you about a CME conference that I will be speaking at in the new year from February 28th to March 7th, 2026. It is an amazing conference. It is the Holiday Seminars Conference in Maui at the Hyatt Regency Maui Resort and Spa. I have been there before. I've spoken at this before, and it is incredible. The family, the Smith family that puts this on, they really do an incredible job. It's going to be some amazing speakers. It's a beautiful hotel and an opportunity to really enjoy Hawaii and Maui, and especially at a time when Maui is trying to recover from the wildfires. They're really going all out to try to make the tourist experience an amazing one. So I think this is a great year to come, and the conference is going to be incredible. You're going to hear from amazing speakers who are going to go over really, really high-yield topics. I highly, highly recommend signing up for this. You can go to holidayseminars.com and click on the Maui link, and you can register there. You can use CME money. It is going to be amazing. So I hope I will get a chance to see you there. It'll be a ton of fun. Before we begin today's episode, we want to acknowledge that we'll be discussing suicide, which can be a difficult and triggering topic for some listeners. If you or someone you know is struggling with suicidal thoughts, please know that help is available. You can reach the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline by calling or texting 988 or chatting online at 988lifeline.org. This free confidential service provides 24/7 support from trained crisis counselors. We encourage you to prioritize your well-being and reach out for help if you need it. If this content feels overwhelming, please consider pausing and returning when you feel ready or listening with support nearby. Thank you. All right, and now we'll begin. Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we have an incredibly important show for you today. I have with me three guests, and we're going to talk about mental health care for physicians and how important it is to try to make that more accessible and reduce barriers to physicians getting that super important care. I have with me Dr. Christine Yu Moutier, who serves as the Chief Medical Officer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She's dedicated herself to fighting this leading cause of death. And for the past decade, she's been the CMO at AFSP and has been a leading voice nationwide in the movement that's fueled by science and grassroots to reduce suicide. I also have Dr. Jesse Ehrenfeld, who returns to the show. Dr. Ehrenfeld is an anesthesiologist, public health advocate, past president of the American Medical Association, and he serves as a senior associate dean, executive director of the Advancing a Healthier Wisconsin Endowment, and a professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. His work focuses on health equity, physician well-being, and the responsible integration of technology into clinical practice. And also returning to the show is Dr. Dan Sadowi-Kanefka. Dan is an anesthesiologist and intensivist at Massachusetts General Hospital. He serves as program director for the MGH Anesthesiology Residency, and he is the president of the Emotional PPE Project, a national nonprofit focused on decreasing barriers to help seeking for emotional health needs. Everybody, welcome to the show. I'm so glad that you could be here to talk about this incredibly important issue today.
Thank you so much for having us, Jed.
Thanks for having us on.
Great to be back on.
So, obviously, this is in and of itself an incredibly important issue, but apart from it just being important, maybe you could each say just a few words about what got you interested in trying to make a difference in this space. Dan, do you want to start?
Sure. You know, Jed, I think you'll relate to this as a program director. We take care of physicians in some of the most vulnerable years of their lives. And I've seen how this impacts both their performance and their well-being. A lot of trainees have a lot of things going on, and it's amazing how much of a barrier they put between themselves and mental health care when the care is so impactful, when it really could do so much for them. So that became a really important thing for me in the development of my trainees. And then on a more personal maybe intense note, I've lost colleagues and mentees to the most tragic outcome of this, to suicide. So it became a very, very personally motivating thing for me. And when the pandemic was kicking up in 2020, that's what led to those past experiences, and the pandemic led to us founding the Emotional PPE Project, focusing on decreasing barriers to help seeking.
Thanks, Dan. And as you said, as a fellow PD, I also have had those same experiences and have also lost colleagues to suicide. And it's an incredibly difficult problem, and one we really need to face. So I share your interest and admire what you've done. Christine, how about you?
Yeah, thanks for giving each of us a moment to just talk about this. And how we came to focus on this, certainly for the paper that we just published. But in my case, my life's work is dedicated to suicide prevention at the nationwide public health level. And it really did start for me as in my own journey as a medical student. I was having my own lived experience and then suffered a series of losses that affected me very personally. But by the time that my institution, this was UCSD at the time, was recognizing that there were a series of suicide deaths going on amongst faculty physicians and a couple of medical students as well. I was, in my own journey, was really probably staying in academic medicine in part because I had become so passionate about trying to bridge what I viewed as this really just kind of bizarre experience of the culture, where it was not really acceptable to acknowledge the reality of being human and all of the things that brings in terms of our own mental health. So at UCSD, after a series of more than a dozen suicides, I was one of the faculty who in the dean's office also was sort of put in charge of getting to the bottom of it. It was the way that the CEO of the hospital and the big D dean of the medical school put it, and trying to do something about it. And that was the start of the UCSD HEAR program, which we've published on a number of times. And really got to see how this is challenging, kind of messy, and yet effective work that can be done with a group of people who come together to focus on increasing access to mental health care. There are systemic issues, there are cultural issues, there are real barriers that I'm sure we're going to get into here, but really creating a sense of psychological safety for people to take those steps. And, you know, I learned myself how completely life-changing that can be, where then you can go on to, in a way, live more freely, to take risks, to be able to live authentically. And hopefully, if you're in a setting that embraces that and where it's going well, really kind of fulfill a potential that could have been really negatively impacted for me. I mean, for me, myself, I was really thinking that I would not continue in medicine because the culture was not a place where I could see myself. So that I hope that is not the case for people, and that there are ways into finding, you know, a sense of well-being, a sense of community, and taking care of your mental health is a big part of that.
Thanks so much, Christine. Jesse, how about you?
Well, thanks again for having me back, Jed. It's great to talk about this really important topic. As I think you and many of your listeners know, I spent 11 years in leadership and ultimately at the helm of the American Medical Association, where the charge was elevating the art and science of medicine and a better public health. And when I was chair of the board in 2020 and COVID hit, it was really profound what I watched, what we watched happen in terms of the challenges, the stress, the exhaustion, the burnout and the, in many cases, tragic outcomes that so many of our colleagues faced as we put aside, in many cases, our own needs to take care of our patients and our communities at the peak of COVID. And that really stuck with me in many ways as I thought about how could I use the platform, the opportunity that I had to serve in that particular posting, but in other aspects of my life to make a difference, to make things better, to try to get the systemic problems that drive so much of the challenge of getting through somebody's day and to restore the joy in the practice of medicine. And for me, I unfortunately lost a very dear medical school classmate to suicide. I talked about him in my inauguration speech when I became AMA president. I've lost trainees, I've lost colleagues in my practice, and all of those losses are too many. So the opportunity to do anything in the space, in any capacity where I have influence, whether it's writing a paper with these incredible minds to elevate what are real solutions and opportunities to do better, to invest in solutions and the work that I do leading a philanthropy in Wisconsin, or to push on policy at the federal level, I'm all in. And that's really what drives me.
Thanks so much, Jesse. Let's start by talking about the mental health challenges that physicians face. What do we think of that maybe are unique for physicians or that physicians may face in a different way than the general public?
You know, we see levels of mental health distress throughout, you know, from medical student life through residency and into one's career at very concerning levels. What is interesting to note is that when medical students enter medical school, their well-being and mental health symptoms by most recent surveys and research shows that they're at a more positive level, actually, than their age-matched peers. But that very quickly, distress levels set in and begin to deepen. We also see that there's a point right before residency where well-being also is doing pretty well. And then soon after beginning residency, then levels of symptoms of, some of the screening tools are kind of proxies for depression. But around 28% of residents overall is thought to be kind of the portion of residents who probably meet criteria for a very significant clinical depression. So that's almost a third of residents. And we know that suicidal ideation rates are higher amongst residents than their age match population. And we also have suicide mortality measured amongst residents in a recent ACGME study that finds that suicide is the leading cause of death for residents, although the rate of suicide is lower than their age matched peers. And then we think that later in one's career, in midlife and beyond, mid-career and beyond, that there are obviously fluctuations. Mental health is not only in response to, you know, the learning and work environment and professional factors. There are obviously a multitude of inputs into as complex a health outcome as depression or anxiety or PTSD, substance use dependence, as well as suicide. They're all very complex health outcomes. But the environment does matter a lot. And so, one thing that I will make note of is that we used to think that physicians were an occupation with one of the highest rates of suicide. And we now know through CDC data and more specific physician suicide decedent data using the NVDRS system, which is a more detailed system within the CDC's and the death investigation system, that physicians, women physicians, do die by suicide at a higher rate than non-physician women. But that is the corollary is not true for male physicians overall. But again, that does not mean that there's not some fluctuation in sort of risk and rates over the course of one's career. That is less well worked out.
And Jed, I would just say that the frustrating thing from my vantage point is that we have effective mental health treatments. but physicians don't get them. They don't seek help. They don't raise their hand and say, I can't come into work tomorrow. I've got to take care of myself. They just push forward. That's the crisis here. And that's the frustrating thing because, you know, we self-select. We have cultural challenges where I still remember as a third-year medical student learning what it meant to be a strong medical student. And that whole culture and language around being unyielding and never taking a sick day and being discouraged from having any sense of vulnerability is something that we've got to change. And that's a cultural issue. It ties into the larger societal stigma around getting help when you need it. But something that's very unique to medicine that we have to own as a profession.
Jed, the only thing I'll add just for a couple of statistics, it's around 10% of physicians and trainees who have had suicidal ideation. And it's actually 1 to 2.5% of physicians, which is what I remember when I read that statistic, I was so surprised. 1 to 2.5% of physicians have attempted suicide. The one other thing is we have all of these estimates for, death rates by suicide. But one thing that we also know is that, physician deaths by suicide are more likely to be misclassified, as compared with other groups. So the estimates that we have are likely underestimates, for the total burden in the population.
Yeah. Thanks. So obviously, we know the most tragic outcome of suicide. We know the end point. But when we think about the mental health challenges that a lot of physicians face that may not end in suicide, there's still consequences. So what are the potential consequences for physicians and for their patients that we know come from untreated mental health disorders? And Jesse, you made a great point, which is that the problem here is not just that they exist, but that people aren't willing or able to get help for them. So we're going to come back to what the barriers are and why people aren't getting help. But just give me a little bit of an idea first about what are the consequences of the fact that people aren't getting the help.
Look, physician mental health isn't just about the workforce and our colleagues. It's actually a public health imperative. And we talk about this in the paper. When physicians, clinicians, caregivers suffer, patient care suffers too. And we know that outcomes are worse when people are exhausted, burnout, depressed, suffering in silence and not getting the help that they need. And so, you know, it can be challenging to quantify it. There is data out there. But in my mind, it's very, very clear that it's not just the right thing to do. There's not just a moral imperative to make sure that people can access the help that they need. It's just the right thing to do for our patients.
Yeah. Well, you brought up burnout. Let me just ask this. Is it important to make a distinction between burnout and kind of maybe, and this may not be right, but maybe more treatable diagnoses like major depressive disorder, or no? Are we talking, or do we lump those all together?
Such a critical distinction. You know, we actually talked about this quite a bit as we were putting the paper together. I'll give one angle on it, and then I'll invite maybe Christine and Jess to add to this. But one of the things that I notice is that these days, any form of distress, and my colleagues, whether that's physicians, nurses, whoever, will just say, I'm feeling kind of burnt out. And really what they mean is I'm feeling some form of distress. But they attribute it to burnout. And here's the problem. Because we, I think appropriately, classify burnout as an occupational phenomenon, it's something that really requires systemic reform, organizational reform, we will delay or completely forego seeking therapy for other causes of distress, things like depression and anxiety and PTSD, where the mainstay of treatment is psychotherapy or pharmacotherapy. And so by conflating the two things or by calling everything just burnout, I really worry that's causing its own barrier to help seeking. Because it's sort of everything is just the system and nothing is something we have some agency over to help ourselves with.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, right? You could imagine someone who actually has major depressive disorder who is just feeling like, well, I'm like everybody. We're all burned out, so there's no point in me trying to get treatment because this is nothing other than the burnout that everyone's feeling, right? That I see what you mean as a barrier. Jesse, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I just want to say, Jed, in the way that we address the issues are different, right? There's overlap in some of this, but, you know, burnout is about the system that we're all dropped in that is, you know, often poorly designed with bad technology and all the frustrations that, you know, we need to really fix together. It's a lot of great work for, you know, chief medical officers and people who are really good at thinking about how we deal with process issues. You know, on the flip side, depression and exhaustion and the mental health challenges that come from working in a system that leads to burnout is about the individual. And that's where obviously therapy and other mental health treatments are incredibly important. So, you know, what you're treating obviously is very different if you're treating the system or you're treating the individual. And that's where it's really kind of important to have that distinction in mind. And I'm glad that we're able to talk about today as well as in the paper.
I'll just add on by saying that depression is a medical disease that can be fatal. And it warrants treatment. It affects, you know, it's one of the leading causes of global disability, perhaps the number one now. And so we in medicine and in healthcare should be the most proactive and sort of stigma-free about such a leading cause of death and disability. And so, yeah, the burnout, it's tough. And I get it culturally, kind of boots on the ground, like Dan said. It's so acceptable to talk about burnout, and that's a good thing to recognize distress, but not if it's at the expense of getting, you know, further help that is really going to make the difference. Because one might take some steps if you feel burned out, right? Looking at your sleep hygiene, looking at your alcohol intake, maybe just, you know, looking at some things in the workplace setting like we were talking about. But as far as getting treatment, which is really a necessary step for moderate to severe depression, it's really looked at as a combination of medications and psychotherapy is going to be the most effective way to address that. So it's really kind of a difference between a biopsychosocial, like the medical illness model, and an occupational syndrome model. And I do understand that the experience can have some overlap, and that's where it does get tricky.
Yeah, really important points. So let's talk about the barriers to seeking help. Your paper, and by the way, we will cite that paper in the show notes so people can reference it if they want. But you talk about the fact that fewer than one third of physicians with mental health conditions seek help. So what explains that? What are the barriers preventing them from trying to seek help?
So I'll give a high level sort of the three buckets as we classify them in the paper, and then maybe we can jump into each of those a little bit more. So the first is what Jesse was really nicely speaking towards is this culture that we have where inadequate self-care is even more than normalized. We call it normalized in the paper, but inadequate self-care is almost celebrated, rewarded. You know, it's this badge of honor to work through illness to show like, oh, look, you know, we were so sick, but we still showed up and did all of these things. And it's this hero culture that really gets in the way of seeking help. So at a high level, that's one of them. Thing two is this incredibly powerful stigma, self-stigma, stigma for mental health in others, where we conflate illness and impairment. And along with that stigma, it's all of the professional consequences, real or perceived, that people have around, well, what would happen if I out myself as someone with a mental health condition? People are going to think that I'm impaired. And unfortunately, there's evidence that people do conflate those two. So it's the stigma and the powerful consequences that people perceive. And then lastly, it's just logistical challenges. You know, not only are physicians working incredibly long hours, but they have this pervasive sense of duty that really gets in the way of being able to care for yourself, and coupled with the worries about professional fears, it means that any of the solutions that we find, they have to allow for confidentiality. So at a high level, it's this inadequate self-care that's normalized. It's this fear of professional consequences, and it's the logistical challenges. There's a lot more meat within each of those, but that's probably the high level way, at least that I think about it.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. And I'd love for you guys to dive into those a little bit. I'll just add that I think structurally, the other thing we have is a system that relies so heavily on physician labor with very narrow margins that if somebody does call out, it's really a stress on the on the system and on their colleagues. And so we have a system that reinforces this idea that not only is it heroic to come to work sick, but you're also being generous to your colleagues by working, because if you didn't, it would be a burden on them.
Jed, I'll never forget on call in residency, Mass General Friday night, and I was bending down to pick something up off the floor, and I caught the corner of my forehead on a sharp corner of an OR table and knocked myself out. And so fortunately, the patient was stable. Everything was good. My documentation was up to date, which is always a good tip for those in training and listening. Keep your record there. So if someone needs to take over, they can. They pulled me into an OR next door, hooked him to a monitor. I woke to a neurosurgeon asking me how many fingers he was holding up downstairs for a CT scan, and was sent home. And then I get a call in the morning from my chief who said, how you doing, Jesse? I said, I'm all right. You know, obviously it wasn't a great night. He goes, okay, I need you to come in this morning because we had to pull somebody in last night to cover for you. And that's the expectation. And I think that that's not at all uncommon. And that's something that we need to change.
Yeah.
On the record, just saying that MGH has changed a lot since then. We would absolutely not do that these days.
That's good to hear. But right. But if you think about it, right, if you had said, I'm sorry, I don't think I can come in, it would have put this huge burden. Now that chief has to find someone else to cover, which, someone's going to get pulled off elective or whatever. And so it's a burden. And I think that while it's great to hear that that's changed there, you know, I do still think that in general, it may be that our response would be definitely stay home, but it doesn't mean that there isn't still the stress to figuring that out. And Dan and I both are lucky to run large programs, so we have a little more leeway. But for small programs, it's a much harder thing to cover a resident who has to be gone.
You know, I'll share too, Jed, if I can. I'll quote. So there's this paper. It's an older paper, it was a qualitative study. They interviewed physicians, and they were uncovering this what they called the shadow contract, the idea that you'll work through illness no matter what. And what they ended up doing is they actually wrote out the contract and then in subsequent interviews sort of vetted it. And if it's okay, can I read you what that contract was? So I undertake to protect my partners from the consequences of my being ill. These include having to cover for me and paying locums. I'll protect my partners by working through any illness up to the point where I'm unable to walk. If I have to take time off, I'll return at the earliest possible opportunity. I expect my partners to do the same and reserve the right to make them feel uncomfortable if they violate this contract. In order to keep the contract, I will act on the assumption that all my partners are healthy enough to work at all times. This may mean that from time to time, it's appropriate to ignore evidence of their physical and mental distress and to disregard threats to their well-being. I will also expect my partners not to remind me of my own distress when I am working while sick. That's from Thompson et al. In 2001.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's really sad that that is the case. But I think everyone would understand that while that may not be quite as extreme anymore, it's not gone.
Well, and the layer that, Dan, you've already highlighted it, but, you know, it's one thing to have this sort of superhuman expectation of ourselves and of each other. It's another thing then for that to bleed into affecting our insight so that we, in fact, go into a state of essentially minimizing and probably denial around suicidal thoughts or, you know, massive effects on our sleep, on our well-being, on our perspective. And, you know, the brain is a tricky thing. So when those thoughts are happening inside your own head, it's very difficult to have objectivity about the fact that it is now gone into distortion land. And our brains play tricks on us anyway on a good day, let alone when we're suffering with depression, anxiety, or these clinical syndromes. So I think the assumption that to play this out is that not only are we not supposed to get sick, but if we do get sick, we shouldn't really recognize it. And then alongside feeling that our reputation could be affected, our licensing could be affected if we get treatment. And I think, again, we're going to focus more on treatment. The truth is, as a dean for students and medical education that I was for 10 years at UCSD School of Medicine, I can't tell you how much of the underbelly I got to see in terms of faculty, residents, and medical students, the level of suffering being great, and the number of them, hundreds, that I personally, that was part of my job, was to refer them. Even though I'm a psychiatrist, you know, you don't treat when you're on the dean team. Refer them into therapy, psychiatric treatment, and how well it goes, how much confidentiality is kept in actuality. That side of it and the storytelling around getting the help that you need and recovering, and we don't see that side of it. We see the side where it's all trying to be covered up, and when it does show up, it's probably been unaddressed and spiraling, and so now it is in fact potentially creating problems or creating even impairment. And so I think that assumption around mental illness and impairment in a way got perpetuated by this fact that we drove it all underground and silenced it. And then when you did see it, and when we do see it, it tends to be much more severe.
Yeah, really good point. I want to talk about how we can start to overcome these barriers, but also I'm interested in your thoughts on how we be careful not to overcorrect. And what I mean is that, you know, you could imagine a situation where we shift so far that people say, well, look, you know, I'm on vacation. I'm supposed to come back to work Monday, but actually it'd be better for my wellness to, you know, to extend that vacation last minute and not come back, or maybe a couple days, or, you know, I woke up this morning and, you know, I just felt like it'd be more fun to go play golf than to come to work, right? I mean, I'm pushing this analogy, obviously, but we do want, we value the physician's sense of duty in the sense of I have a, you know, I am taking care of patients. I am trying to save their lives. I'm trying to help them get better. We don't want to lose that, but we don't want the extreme that has existed of this feeling that that must come before everything, including really significant provider impairment in terms of mental health. So how do we find the balance? How do we overcome the barriers while still maintaining that sense of you know, valuable duty that physicians have to their patients?
I mean, ultimately, Jed, I think this comes down to our shared professional identity in sort of the medical education world. That whole concept of professional identity formation is so critical. And how do we set the right expectations for how one operates as a professional in this field? And, you know, I think I will tell you, you know, there's nothing great about a pandemic, but I will tell you, I have seen people actually call in sick since COVID started, because I think we've finally recognized that maybe it's not a great idea to show up coughing all over my patients. And I think that, you know, a little thing like that actually is an important signal that maybe we're starting to get this right, but obviously we have a lot of work to do.
I also, Jesse, have said, and I really believe that is one of the really good things that came out of COVID. It was such a sea change in people being willing to say, you know, I actually should not come to work sick, where before that it was such a rare thing.
Yeah.
Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, folks, the countdown is on. Holiday shopping season is officially here. Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique, high-quality finds you won't see anywhere else. Don't wait. The most meaningful gifts get scooped up fast, and now's the perfect time to cross names off your list. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high-quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, making every gift feel meaningful and truly one of a kind. I found these foldable cat toys that I got for my kids, and they loved them. They were able to put them together, and they each wanted one in their room. And my wife and I loved that we were helping an independently owned small business. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, and diehard football fans to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that won't be available anywhere else. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ACRAC. That's uncommongoods.com/ACCRAC for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. Hey, folks, you know what can make a real difference in your quality of life at work? Comfortable scrubs. And not just any scrubs, but Figs scrubs. They're made for awesome humans and I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers. These are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my Figs, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers too. She wears them to work every day, as do so many of the doctors and nurses I work with. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist like me, or even a medical student starting out. Investing in a couple pairs of Figs is totally worth it. We are partnering with Figs to get you 15% off your first purchase when you use code FIGSRX at wearfigs.com. Figs goes beyond scrubs, too. They've got shoes, underscrubs, and even jackets that will make the ever-present hospital AC seem like a thing of the past. And they come in a wide range of colors that will let your personality shine through. Try Figs today by going to wearfigs.com and get 15% off your first order when you enter code FIGSRX at checkout. That's 15% off when you enter code FIGSRX. Hey, ACRackers, we are thrilled to have as a returning sponsor the one and only TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. I love that it's customizable, so you can target weak areas or take a longer or shorter practice exam anytime. Their metrics are great, and their mobile app lets you study on the go. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. And now they have a fabulous flashcard product, which you can check out, and I highly recommend it. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACCRAC. Hey folks, fall always feels like a reset. Between back to school, busier routines, and shorter days, finding time to cook can be tough. That's why I love Factor. Their chef-prepped, dietitian-approved meals make it easy to stay on track and enjoy something comforting and delicious no matter how hectic the season gets. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and it really does. Even my two younger daughters, who are very picky eaters, are loving every meal we get from Factor. Some favorites are the chicken tikka masala and premium proteins like salmon and shrimp that come at no extra cost. And with 65 different meal options, you've got GLP-1 friendly meals packed with protein and healthy fats and savory global flavors like the new Asian and inspired meals influenced by China, Thailand, and more. 97% of customers say Factor helped them live a healthier life, and the amazing thing is that it's not just healthy, but super fast and incredibly tasty. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Get started at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for a year. That's code ACCRAC50OFF at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off plus free breakfast for an entire year. All right, and we're back.
Jed, it occurs to me, so I don't think any system will ever be perfect. Certainly, we're historically way out of balance, though. But the one thing about sort of considering it like a balance is it sort of frames these as, you know, you're either doing one or you're doing the other. And I think it's a little bit of a false dichotomy. And one of the solutions I think has to come from leadership, role modeling, that you can have a really, really amazing sense of duty and still take care of yourself when you need to take care of yourself.
Yes, 100%. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I just want to piggyback on that. I mean, at a very early stage in this, in our fields, grappling with these topics, I was teaching medical students and residents about the mental health issues and self-care and care for one another, caring for colleagues, and teaching it as a professional responsibility. So I think, you know, Jed, your question is a good one, but I do think it is a false dichotomy or a false narrative to think that mental health is somehow different from physical health as it relates to people taking advantage of. That's its own, you know, bailiwick, that is a problem to be dealt with. But to me, it doesn't have much connection with getting, you know, getting mental health treatment. And I would, again, just what helps me frame it up whenever things start getting kind of blurry like that is, I think, you know, mental health and physical health, and how would we recommend, you know, a colleague or a trainee addressing a physical health matter. And that's going to have a parallel for mental health that'll be right on track, you know, very similar.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point. The other thing I like is to think about, I tell people, you know, let's say that you're supposed to have a medical student with you in the OR, you know, this is obviously an anesthesia analogy here, but you're supposed to have the medical student in the OR with you the next day. And then they call you the night before and they say, you know, I'm so sorry, I'm not feeling well. I don't think I'm going to be able to come in the next day. What's your reaction? It is nothing but generosity, right? You're like, oh, I'm so sorry that you're feeling sick. Please, you know, take the day off. If you need another day after that, that's totally fine, right? I mean, there's nothing but take care of yourself. Don't worry about it, because there's no consequence to that medical student not coming in terms of staffing or work getting done. And if we just use that as a model, right, that's how we should react to a resident or fellow or attending calling out, even though there are consequences. But if we use that as a guiding principle, that's how we should react, right? I mean, that makes sense.
Did I have to tell you, so we're recording this today. This is not going to be live. So we produced, I don't want you to release it, just before the start of Rosh Hashanah. And I still remember as a third year medical student on rotation, being so sheepish and afraid to ask, my resident, if I could leave a few hours early, to go be with a classmate's family, for the Jewish high holidays. And eventually I got up the nerve to ask, and he said, I'm actually disappointed that you didn't ask me earlier. You should absolutely leave now. And he said parenthetically, by the way, don't worry. You'll have plenty of other time to disappoint your family and friends in your career as a physician. This doesn't need to be one of them. And that's just stuck with me, right? As obviously I have interactions with trainees, and colleagues, and try to figure out again, how do we set that right balance, for people to do the things to take care of themselves.
Yeah.
We just have not to say that we're all the same, we're not clones of each other, but collectively we have a very overbearing superego on ourselves. You know, I your story, Jesse, just reminded me for some reason of when I was pregnant as a chief resident. And I am very close to this day with my training director. He remains my, my friend, colleague, and mentor, Sid Zisick. And I had such a hard time telling him that I was pregnant because of what it would mean in terms of the program. And I worried about the interns. And, you know, I frankly kind of overinflated my role and how critical, and that it wouldn't be able to get covered. And we just really struggle with it's, I think it's internal traits, and then it's a system that just has built around that.
Yeah.
Jed, yeah, I think these stories are so powerful for people to hear. You know, I share a couple stories. I won't share all of them right now because they're very vulnerable stories. Not that I'm not happy to be vulnerable, but I think it would probably derail us a little bit. But one I'll share, you know, and I with my residents when they start, is I was on thoracic anesthesia, and my grandmother, who lived in Venezuela at the time, had a cardiac arrest. She was on, you know, X number of pressors in this really small clinic in Venezuela without much. And I thought, like, my first thought was, but I can't go because I'm on thoracic. And I didn't even, and I fortunately, one of my faculty saw me looking quite distressed and asked me what was going on. And I shared it with him, and sort of lamented the fact that I couldn't go. And, I don't know, he didn't say it quite so bluntly, but the sentiment he gave me, which is just such an important one for, I think, us all to understand, is you're very special, but you're not that important. We'll be okay. You got to go take care of yourself and your family. So I think it is just such that it's true. As soon, Jess, as you said that, I thought, oh yeah, this is happening to Christine as well. And I think we probably all can think of these things in times where we've made the right decision to prioritize our self-care, and times where we probably haven't made the right decision, but, making sure that especially, you know, folks like us, folks listening who are in leadership positions or to think about, like, what are the stories that you can share with the people who look up to you? And if you're not yet in that position, if you're thinking about for yourself, should I take the time right now, fast forward 10, 20 years, you know, what is the story that you're going to want to be able to tell to your mentee about what you did when this happened to you? And I think, I don't know why I think that, maybe it's because of our selfless natures in general. The idea that we're doing this to help someone in the future make the right decision maybe makes it a little bit easier to self-care, to prioritize self-care when we need to.
Yeah. So I think that's such a good point. And so one, taking us back to the question about how to overcome the barrier. So one you've brought up, Dan, and we've given some examples of is leaders can set the tone that this is okay. And not only okay, but important to do, right? To take the time when you need it, to see the sick family member, to take care of yourself. What are some other ways structurally that we can make change that will help reduce the barriers to physicians getting the help they need?
So there are a lot. I'm going to enumerate some, and then I'm going to call on my expert colleagues here to give more examples. But at a high level, we need education about the commonality of these conditions, the importance and the benefits of help seeking, and how to recognize distress in yourself or others. So we need education. We need the role modeling, as you said. I think we have certain programs that we know are effective in either normalizing help seeking or making that easy. So those are things like peer support programs, anonymous screening programs. We need a variety of confidential counseling options. Because what might seem safe for one physician won't seem safe for another. So having a variety of confidential counseling options is important. There are some really innovative programs out there that include things like opt-out programs. So where the default is actually you seek care. You don't seek care. The default is you're scheduled for care. We need to work on external oversight and licensing and credentialing reform and state-led programs. So at a high level, those are some of the things, but there's more meat on all of those. If it's okay, Jed, I might, just to kick that off, ask Christine to talk a little bit more about some of the anonymous screening programs and the benefits of those.
Please. That'd be great.
Sure. So actually, one of the reasons I work at AFSP now and how I met the nonprofit I now work for is that when we were looking for a tool that had evidence for, you know, helping reduce the barrier to help seeking, we found this tool called the Interactive Screening Program that AFSP had developed for colleges and universities. It's now in workplaces, law enforcement, healthcare, as well as colleges and universities. And it's not a treatment tool and it's not a diagnostic tool, but people can stay completely anonymous if they choose to. And that's what makes it unique. And there is a real live trained mental health clinician, again, not providing treatment on the other end, but really working through what is this? Is this something serious that I'm experiencing? What are the safe avenues for taking that next step? And so there's good data to show that there are, like we've known about, a large portion of people in any healthcare, health worker setting that are suffering greatly in silence and not talking to anyone about it, not seeking treatment. And the anonymity piece just allows them to kind of work through their questions. So it's a very kind of unique way to sort of reach the group that, as a dean, they're the group I worried about the most. We had the students who were coming in. We knew, we kind of felt like we had an understanding of what was happening with them and were engaging with them in some way. And you know, again, oftentimes sending them to treatment as well as the mentorship piece. But we also were well aware that if people didn't come in of their own accord, that it was that silent, quiet group that, again, you know, when tragedy hits, oftentimes many folks will say it that they were completely blindsided. But and then you start putting the pieces together and everyone saw little snippets of concern, but we're not acting in concert. And so that anonymity piece can help those who otherwise aren't really finding ways to speak up to get some help.
Yeah, thanks. That's really important. Other comments you guys want to make about the ways to reduce barriers?
You know, I just think that there's a lot that goes with leadership modeling. And when I deployed in the Navy, was Afghanistan and all the things, I still will never forget one of my leaders saying, it's obviously up to you all how you take, and this was a medical unit, right? We were taking care of patients in Afghanistan. So you all know what to do to take care of yourselves. But I'm going to talk to the psychiatrist before we redeploy and head home. And I think it's a good idea that everybody do the same. And, you know, no forced fun, not a mandatory activity, but that openness and that demonstrated ability to take care of themselves, share their own mental health journey, goes a lot to break down the stigma and build the trust. And I think we need more of that, certainly across the profession.
Yeah. I'll just highlight essentially what Dan has already said, and Jesse, that was fantastic as well. The modeling is just so, you need to have those other structural and planned tools and education, and it's, again, it's multi-layered. This has really got to be sort of multi-pronged. You could look at the mental health, preventing mental health outcomes, including suicide, that you have to take a public health approach. So it needs to actually be multi-tiered. And for those of us in medicine, sometimes it's hard to take our clinical hat off and actually put on more of that public health or administrative leader role view of this. And so universal, targeted, selected, and all the ways that you can sort of creatively customize. But the key is to have a strategy that is sustained and measuring impact and kind of evolving along the way. So honestly, the work, the way that I found to do it was to band with a group of like-minded people and to kind of have your eye on the prize over years. And I'm sorry to make it that long-term a commitment, but these things don't change overnight. And so you actually have to sort of plan for some resistance along the way, right? You're trying to disrupt a current status quo, essentially. And again, you know, I think what Jess just shared about his leader expressing first by saying, I'm going to see the psychiatrist. I think the little ways that you as a leader or even whatever role you play in your work setting, do not underestimate the way you even informally talk about your own family issues, mental health. You don't have to out anybody. It does not have to be oversharing, but you give a nod to the fact that we're all human, we're all going through stuff. And, you know, I think the people who mentioned their own therapy, like, oh yeah, I wanted to talk to my therapist about that. Just like a little side comment, boom, huge signal that I'm someone who prioritizes mental health. I make it, you know, it becomes psychologically safer at least to talk about it then.
Yeah. Fabulous. Dan?
So I think it probably is worthwhile just sharing a couple of what the confidential counseling options are. I suspect a lot of listeners will be familiar with these. Some of them may not, though. So employee assistance program, these are through institutions. Typically, they have administrative firewalls, so there really are no professional consequences. They're confidential. It doesn't go into record. All of those sorts of things are phenomenal resources. There's also physician health programs, and historically they had historically had a reputation, I think, for being a little more regulatory, punitive. There's been quite a transformation in them, and they help for all manner of health things in many cases. And I'll say a couple more things, and then maybe I'll ask Jess to comment a little bit on just give some really grounded examples of because of his role in Wisconsin. And then there's also organizations like the nonprofit that I help lead, the Emotional PPE Project. We do research and advocacy, but we also have a directory of therapists who are willing to offer pro bono sessions to anyone in healthcare. No paperwork, no finance exchange, really to just decrease that barrier to entry. So this is what I was talking about with just a whole mix of different options for therapy. Jess, can I call on you to talk a little bit about some of the state level stuff, maybe Wisconsin as an example, but more broadly?
Yeah, no, I'd love to do that. So my day job when I'm not in scrubs taking care of patients in Milwaukee is running the largest health philanthropy in the state. And we are making a significant $10 million commitment to the well-being of our healthcare workers. A big piece of that is to try to address the gap in terms of people being able to have access to mental health services when they need it. So we issued a $2.5 million grant to the medical society to work with all of the professional health associations around the state to establish what will be a Wisconsin healthcare professional services program, like a physician health program, but for all licensed health practitioners, nurses, pharmacists, PAs, doctors, to provide confidential referral and monitoring services for anybody who's licensed in the state who has a behavioral, psychiatric, substance use, or other issue that they need. There's only one state in the nation that has a comprehensive program like that today. It's Ohio. We're hoping to be the second. This is important because today in Wisconsin, we don't have a physician health program. We don't have a health program for anybody. And we had a really interesting experience occur. The State Medical Society partnered with an online telehealth behavioral health platform that's really geared for clinicians. And instantly, as soon as they made this available to their members, they saw more than 200 physicians sign up for online services with tremendous satisfaction, tremendous agreement to continue using these services. The top five reasons that people wanted support was anxiety, stress, family issues, depression, and other mood issues. Most of the appointments that this platform has seen are happening between 5 and 10 o'clock at night, as well as early in the morning. And what's really telling is that we know based on just where this was deployed in the pilot program that's going on in the state, most of the physicians who are using this service in partnership with the State Medical Society have access to their own employee assistance program. They're just not using it, because they are afraid, they're fearful, they're worried about confidentiality, or it's not convenient. You can only go at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and you have to be in the hour until six. So there's a lot of opportunity to improve, and we're hopeful that in Wisconsin, we can be a model for the nation of what's possible by bringing folks together to make these kinds of services more accessible so that when people do raise their hand and they say, I need help, they have a place to go.
That's fabulous. Thanks, Jesse. Dan, you were going to say something?
Yeah, no, just it's incredible what you can do when you make care confidential, accessible, and convenient. You know, a third of physicians, fewer seek help, but when you actually build solutions that work, they will seek help. The one other thing that I wanted to mention, well, it's two separate thoughts. So first thought, just what Jesse was alluding to about this being for all healthcare workers, this seems like a good time to say, you know, we wrote about physicians because there's a lot of literature about physicians. The journal that we published in was JAMA. There's a whole bunch of reasons that we wrote about it. There's not as much literature around other healthcare workers, but all the literature that we have points to the exact same issues. And so I feel like it's really important to say this is a healthcare worker issue. It's not just a physician issue, and lack of literature does not mean lack of need. So just to make that point. And then, you know, it's a quick pivot, but the other things that are the other work being done, which certainly listeners can get involved in if they want, but it's at a higher level. There's a tremendous amount of work going into licensing reform. We haven't gotten into it, but there's been a history of invasive licensing questions that conflate illness and impairment, credentialing questions. And there's a huge movement. Lots of change has happened in just the last 5 years, actually, to change these, to really just be asking about fitness for duty and not asking about mental health conditions that have nothing to do with impairment. So that's work that's ongoing. A lot of work still needs to be done to communicate to clinicians so that they develop trust in these applications. And then lastly, there's other, you know, legislation and federal work to be done. Jess has, I know, talked a lot about and looked a lot at mental health parity laws, And then there's also the Lorna Breen Healthcare Worker Act that's up for reauthorization, which would provide substantial funding. It was authorized, I think, in 2022 under Biden. It's up for there's a bill both in the Senate and the House. It's up for reauthorization, but hasn't been prioritized in the current climate. But it is something that has bipartisan support that would fund a lot of really important work.
Yeah, this is so important. Well, this has been such a great and super important conversation. I want to give you each, if you have any things you think we didn't cover or you want to just point out before we move on, anything you want to mention?
Well, look, I think it's just important to emphasize that getting help, seeking help, raising your hand is not a weakness, it's a strength. And I hope that collectively, us talking today, everybody who's listening, everybody who has any influence at all in the healthcare system can come together to build a system where ultimately everybody feels safe and supported and empowered to get the care that they need.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'll echo that and say that I think we all have our own individual reasons. And look, when you're not feeling well, that's another issue that really can drive a person to just feel extra vulnerable and an extra load of, in a way, self-stigma is one way to look at it. In that sense, it really is incumbent upon all of us who, when we're doing well, hopefully pretty well, that we're looking out for each other, that we're actually reaching in. When someone is struggling, they're not in the best position to be able to make it, you know, stick their neck out on a line, it feels like, to be figuring that out. And so you can actually play a really pivotal role just by pulling someone aside and having a supportive, caring conversation where essentially you just listen to them. You open up a safe space and ask how they're doing and, you know, have some resources on the ready, but it's not even necessarily about that as much as just being able to hear them. And once they experience that a colleague is sort of receptive and caring, that might actually be empowering and sort of therapeutic on its own, let alone then following up is really important to do. If somebody discloses something very private, no matter what it is, including mental health, you always want to follow back up and say, hey, thanks so much for trusting me with that. Thanks for having that conversation. I'm still thinking about you. I'm still here. Do you want to grab coffee again? You know, that goes a long way to empowering that person on their own kind of journey towards seeking help. And the communication piece about the credentialing and licensing boards that are, in fact, going through reform. It's quite incredible. The Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation has a toolkit, and they've been essentially effective at having sort of some sweeping, more rapid change than we'd seen for decades before then. And so there's a good chance that you may now live and practice in a state where those discriminatory practices are no longer. But if you're not aware of that, you might still be keeping, you know, silenced because you're not aware of that. And so, again, that communication strategy. And I will just say, once you become somebody who seeks help, and you do start, you know, talking about it in trusted circles, you will be amazed at the power of kind of solidarity and the freedom. There is this sort of like unintended benefit of just authenticity and having that community of colleagues and folks who are, kind of supporting one another in that way.
Absolutely. Dan?
A little bit of the same. I'll try to cast a slightly different direction of light. If you yourself are feeling distressed right now, it's not your role to self-diagnose, but just consider seeking help. We have this issue in medicine where we say, oh, it's just part of the job, or it's just a phase, or things will be better when. But if you're feeling distressed, it might be something that you don't need to be feeling. I know that was the case for me when I started therapy in 2020. It was just like a holy smoke. I didn't realize that I just didn't need all of that. You know, these weights are off. So, just think about it. And if it still feels hard to do, think about your mentee 5-10 years down the road and what you're going to want to be able to tell them that you did when you were feeling the way that they might be feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been such an important conversation, and I've learned a lot. I know our listeners will too. We'll put some links in the show notes to both your article and other resources. But let's, along the lines of trying to increase wellness, let's turn to our random recommendations, and I'll ask each of you to recommend something that listeners can check out for fun and enjoyment. Christine, you want to start?
I will start, and believe it or not, this is fun to me, and it does sort of relate to our topic. So for anyone who has not watched the show Ted Lasso, you are missing out. It is not only fun, funky, and but you have to get past the first couple of episodes because they're a little weird to start. But once you do, there is something very special and endearing about that show. And it actually portrays culture change related to the very topic we're talking about, including a therapist for a sports team who herself is facing challenges. So it's the subject matter, even though it's a comedy, is actually handled in some very unique, special ways. I look for things that are like light and fun so I can kind of unplug. And look, you know, mental health and suicide as topics are actually all around us in you know, literature and entertainment. And sometimes they're handled well and sometimes not. But this one I thought was all good.
Fabulous. Jesse?
Well, since your listeners here are already on the podcast train, after they've caught up on all missed episodes of ACRAC, I would highly recommend, there's an episode called The Case for Optimism from the Ezra Klein Show. Really great conversation about how to stay hopeful in a world where there's so much disruption going on. And I think more than ever, particularly for physicians, where there's a lot of stress and concern about the future of the healthcare system. It's just a really, really great episode. Case for Optimism from Ezra Klein.
Fabulous. Dan?
I'll do a show recommendation, although I'm sure someone at some point on ACRAC has recommended this. I tend not to see shows for some time. This is a show from like a decade ago, The Good Place. If you haven't seen it, it's funny, it's quirky, it's uplifting. So it's Kirsten Bell and Ted Danson and a few other folks.
Yeah, that is one of my daughters. That's her favorite show. Well, I'm going to recommend a movie, and it may seem silly, but I'm going to recommend K-Pop Demon Hunters, which if you have a daughter, or maybe any kid, I don't know, I only have daughters, between the age of, I don't know, 5 and 15, then you've already seen it many times, as I have. But I, when they first told me, Daddy, you have to watch this, I said, what? That sounds horrible. There's no way. But they, you know, you can't say no to your daughters, and so I agreed. And I've subsequently watched it many times, and it is pretty much the only music that is ever on in the car anymore in my household. And it's great. It's actually a really entertaining movie with a fabulous soundtrack. It's hard to get those songs out of your head. And it's got a great message. I mean, the message of the movie really is that, and it's very much in line with what we talked about, that you should be open about all that is inside you, the good, the struggles, and that by being open and letting the scars shine through, you'll be more authentic. And it really reminded me, Christine, of what you said, which is that when you do that, you will feel liberated. You will feel like you're no longer have this stress of trying to hide anything. And that's exactly what the movie is about. So really, I thought it was appropriate and worth watching. Even if you don't have young kids, it's worth watching. All right. Thank you all for coming on the show. This has been fabulous.
Thanks so much, Jed.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit, and we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAG music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAG podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
In cybersecurity, speed isn't just an advantage, it's survival. SOC Radar is your early warning system against hackers. SOC Radar continuously monitors the external threat landscape, so cyber threats hit your radar before they hit your business. But it doesn't stop there. SOC Radar empowers your company with proactive exposure management, actionable insights that help you stay ahead of cyber criminals and minimize business impact. And with SOC Radar's holistic exposure management, you get complete visibility, attack surface monitoring, dark web monitoring, threat intelligence, and brand protection are all unified in one powerful platform. SOC Radar isn't just another tool. It's your frontline defense in a world where threats never sleep. Start your free trial at socradar.io/podcast. That's socradar.io/podcast. Don't wait.